to purchase food, acquire supplies, and pay staff at over 154 sites across the state. Those willing to help can donate at bgcwisconsin.org.
This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Lenny Aquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, and Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist at the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today. Today's program.
Good morning. This is Lenny Aquinta for Community Matters. Our topic this morning is COVID-19 from a nursing perspective in Southeast Wisconsin. My guests are the directors of two of the nurse training programs in our listening area, Rochelle Nelson, Clinical Assistant Professor and Director of Nursing at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and Frank Hicks, Professor and Director of Nursing at Carthage College. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Len.
Now, before I go further, I want our listeners to know that we are recording this 25 hours prior to broadcast time in case things happen that we don't reference. Professors, let's begin by talking about what's closest to your hearts at the moment, the nurses. You've been preparing to graduate this spring and are preparing to be graduating in the next year. How is the COVID-19 pandemic affecting your students? Let's begin with you, Professor Hicks at Carthage. What's happening with your students and programs, sir?
Well, this is totally unprecedented. I've been a nurse educator for 30 years, and I've never had anything like this happen before. With the advent of the pandemic, and understandably, most of the hospitals and our other clinical partners prohibited students from going to clinical. And shortly thereafter, the college just made a decision to shift from face-to-face classes to online classes, which meant that the faculty basically had a week to prepare, to convert their courses over, including the clinical courses. And it's particularly, I think, sad for the seniors because this is a very exciting time for them. They were just about ready to go into their immersion clinical, which is their precepted intensive clinical that they do at the end to help their transition to the role of a professional nurse. And all those clinicals got canceled. So we had to scramble and find ways to help them meet the learning objectives that they need to meet for that clinical. But moreover, it was very disappointing to them because now we're not going to be able to have the pinning ceremony. We're not going to be able to have graduation. So we're trying to think of ways that we're going to be able to honor this class. I mean, this is a very exciting time for senior nursing students. They've worked very hard to get where they are. They've overcome a lot of challenges, and it's a time of celebration. And so they're all a little bit sad and a little bit disappointed that this isn't going to happen.
You know, I really appreciate that, Professor Hicks. I used to work as a fundraiser and alumni director at colleges and universities, and I've never seen a group at a university setting that's tighter as a cohort as the nursing cohort that graduates each year. And that pinning ceremony is extremely emotional and important to nurses and their families. If you've never witnessed it, I don't think it's possible to really understand and empathize with the feeling that's involved. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you replace the hands-on clinical work at the end of their courses of training? What is it that you're having them do instead?
Well, we have been very fortunate that we have some really excellent resources at our fingertips. We have an excellent learning management system called ATI. It stands for Assessment Technologies Incorporated. A lot of nursing schools use that platform. And within that platform, there are a lot of virtual simulations. We also have virtual simulations through one of the textbook companies that we use. So we have these virtual simulations that we're able to simulate clinical experiences and clinical situations. And what we're really focusing on, I mean, we focus on this throughout the program, we're really focusing on honing in their clinical judgment. And these vSIMs, that's what they're called, the virtual simulations are called vSIMs. These vSIMs are an excellent way to be able to do that. It also, in some ways, gives the faculty a little bit more insight because we're able to look at their performance and we're able to look at areas where they need to be improved and areas, you know, where they're doing really, really well. And furthermore, the vSIMs really do an excellent preparation for the NCLEX, which is the licensing examination. And that's the thing that we're really focusing on with the students with the seniors at this point in time, is helping them to get ready for their NCLEX, which they will take once they graduate in May.
Is that going to be delayed, that test taking?
There's been talk about that. They're thinking that there's going to be a backlog of students, but I think the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, they're the group that run the NCLEX, they're trying to do as much as they possibly can to continue to be able to test, because, I mean, frankly, we're going to need the nurses. And so the last communication I saw from NCSBN, they were really trying to think of ways that they would be able to administer the examination and hoping that this is going to be over with by the end of May, beginning of June, which is about the time that we would be registering or we would be verifying students for the NCLEX. Typically, at least my students, I don't know about Rochelle, but my students usually take the NCLEX late June, early July, because it usually takes them that long to process. But it might actually push them back later into summer, maybe later part of July, beginning of August. I think we're just going to have to wait and see what that is. But the students are aware of that. And, you know, I live in Illinois. I live in Chicago, actually. And Chicago does not have, at this point in time, Illinois does not have temporary licenses. But I believe that Wisconsin does. And so I think that is a venue for them to be able to go as well.
So it would be possible for these nurses graduating or finishing their training at the universities and colleges in May to begin work at the end of the summer?
It depends on the state they want to practice in, and it depends on what the nurse practice act does in that state.
All right.
Professor Nelson, why don't you pick up from there and talk about specifically the UW Parkside program and other aspects of this situation for our graduating students.
Yeah. So our concerns are very much the same as the other colleges of nursing in our area. Everything that Frank said, I pretty much can agree with that information. We had a little more, maybe a little bit more heads up time because we were heading into our spring break when this all occurred. So we had about 2 weeks to prepare to put our classes online, to figure out how we were going to provide clinical hours for our students. We also use the ATI product, which is an excellent virtual, there are virtual simulations. We're preparing our students to sit for that NCLEX exam. We're using all of the resources that we have available. And with the technology that we have now, if this was 10 years ago, I think the challenge would be even greater to get things started as quickly as we've been able to. So we're working on preparing our senior students to graduate in May. We're on target for that date. We unfortunately, our seniors too will miss out on that celebration of graduation and the pinning ceremony, so we're looking at how we can do that in a virtual way. Our student nurses who are involved in the community are having some difficulties volunteering and working with people in the community just because of all the social distancing and staying at home, but they are trying to fundraise or trying to work with others at a distance. We're trying to stay connected with the students. Trying to think if there was something else. There was something else that you said, Frank, that I'm sorry I just didn't pick up on. But I was on the NCSBN website this morning, and it looks like they're starting to open sites, and there are people that are starting to test that have already graduated. So if they can get not so many more sites, but more employees, they might be able to open up, and we might be able to stay pretty much on track for the students to sit for their NCLEX at the early and probably end of June, probably not much sooner than that. And in Wisconsin, we do not have a temporary graduate nursing licensure as we did before. That might be something that's considered by the state board. I haven't heard yet.
Listening between the lines, so to speak, it seems to me that while there are disadvantages to what's happening currently for the final training of these nurses that we're sending out, that there are also advantages to the virtual techniques that you're using that you didn't always have before. So it's a balance, it sounds like to me.
I think so. I think, you know, I think it's I think there's going to be some good things that come out of this, not only for schools of nursing, but I also think for the profession. You know, here in Illinois, I don't think they have the same regulation in Wisconsin, but here in Illinois, like some advanced practice nurses, they have opened up their they've elevated their practice, and so the CRNA, the Certified Registered Nurse Anesthetist in Illinois, usually had to have some sort of a supervisory physician, a collaborating physician. And they have opened that up in Illinois. They no longer need that. I think that they're starting to see the value of advanced practice nurses, like nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, and seeing that the value of them being able to practice at the full extent of their experience and licensure. I also think for colleges of nursing, and I don't know how you feel about this, Rochelle, but I think this is going to help the faculty think about clinical in a whole new way and think about maybe perhaps doing things differently. I, for a long time, have felt that, you know, we get bogged down in a particular paradigm of how education could go, and it's hard for some people to step out of that paradigm and look at new ways of doing things. This might open the door to some innovation that I think is needed to rethink how we do clinical and rethink how we are educating our students.
I wonder if there are particular. Oh, did you have some comments, Rochelle?
Please go ahead. I agree with Frank's statement about that. I think we've been so locked into face-to-face clinical, hands-on, with the virtual simulations that we have and what's happening now. It would be nice to have a good mix of both the hands-on and the virtual. And perhaps I don't know if it would help us to fast-track students and in a different way, but at least we're going to think about it. I think we're looking at new ways and being more creative.
Yes, I agree.
I'm wondering if you could comment on the different roles that nurses play in not only hospital settings, but other settings in terms of COVID-19 care. Are there certain specialties that are more involved in nursing than others that are of interest and importance today to the country?
I certainly can answer that. There's going to be a need for more public health personnel, community health, people outside of the acute care setting. We're looking at trying to prevent people from becoming ill, and that's the basis of public health, protecting the community, and then the surveillance and that follow-up when people do become ill and the testing. So I think, as I read in the Kenosha News, there was a need to hire, I think they said, 9 nurses very quickly at the start of this. So I know by the time our students graduate, there will be many more positions open in the public community health. Also, our older adults probably need a little bit more support as they are more of a vulnerable at-risk population. We know that we need nurses in the medical surgical area, in the ERs. We need them also in the intensive care units. But I think we're going to start to see more people, more nurses branching out into the community health arena.
And I would agree with that wholeheartedly. And I also think that this situation, as horrible as it is going to I hope the profession starts to rethink the emphasis that it places in education, because we need to start preparing nurses more for population-based health. Mm-hmm. And I think this is an excellent way of sowing the seeds of that field so it happens. You know, I was reflecting on this morning, and, you know, these tragedies, wars and plagues and things like that, as awful as they are often the things that have moved nursing forward. And I think that's happening here as well. I think that, you know, people are really seeing the value of nursing. I think nurses are starting to see the value of things like population health or public health, and I think that my hope is that what happens at the other end of this, when this is all over, that we really do rise to these challenges and really start to innovate the profession and the education of nurses.
For those just tuning in on the half hour on Community Matters this morning, here with me are directors of the two nurse training programs that are probably the largest in our listing area, Professor Frank Hicks of Carthage College and Assistant Professor Rochelle Nelson, Director of Nursing at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. We're so happy to have you both with us. Now, you've probably heard over the air, Governor Cuomo in New York wants health professionals not only to get out of retirement who live in New York State, and they're planning to allow them to have their licenses renewed or extended in some way. And he's also asking people in the health professions from all other states to travel to New York, which sounds like a very wonderful humanitarian thing to do. But it also sounds like maybe an unseemly competition. What are the implications in terms of what's going on? It's more than I can quite figure out what would happen if all the health personnel who aren't needed today in Wisconsin go to New York State. Well, when our peak hits at the end of April, which is what they're forecasting, then what? Any takers on that, professors?
Well, that's a good question. I think that we need to keep our healthcare personnel within our states, and if we do need to assist someone, I would think we might assist our neighbors first. For instance, Illinois and Wisconsin might share some personnel. I think this happened many years ago when we started to bring many foreign-born nurses into the United States so they could help us with long-term care, but then that took away from the healthcare in their own country. So there's some give and take there, and there's some ethical concerns, I think, with taking personnel away from one state to help another. Because then if those healthcare workers go to New York, they work, they become exhausted, they become ill, then who's going to take care of our community here in Wisconsin and Illinois? I do support having retired people fill a need. They may not be doing a lot of hands-on care. They might be doing health promotion, screening, vaccinations. There are quite a few retired nurses that maintain their licensure. So it may just take a little refresher and some training to get them to what we need them to do at the time.
I agree with that. I share the same opinion as Rochelle. I think that, you know, we need to take care of our own. I think at this point in time, I'm not trying to be selfish or, you know, inhumane, but New York is seeing their spike now. We haven't seen our spike yet. Yeah. And we have to have our healthcare professionals here to be able to take care of us, and I fully support asking retired nurses to come back into practice temporarily so they can help with this. I actually registered myself for the Illinois Nurses Registry, and I'm fully ready to go and go back into practice, bedside practice, if I'm called to do so. I think it's our ethical duty to do that.
If the states were to really want the people, as many people as possible, to come back into the profession, could they just at the snap of a fingers reduce regulations and licensing requirements as a state of emergency? Do you happen to know that?
Well, go ahead, Rochelle.
I don't know that for sure, but in the past, I have worked with retired nurses, and I participated in a refresher course to get them up and going. We did not lower the standards. It just, each nurse had a different specialty, and it, you know, if they were going into, say, for instance, a community health area, it was probably less intensive to get them ready to do that, to do health screening, vaccinations, follow-up, that type of care, versus intensive care or cardiology. That would take a little bit more time.
Right.
And thank you for helping differentiate this between the duties and responsibilities. That's an important factor, isn't it?
It is. And you know, Governor Pritzker has already said that he would consider not so much reducing the requirements. I mean, you're still going to have an RN, you're still going to have your license, but he would certainly find ways to facilitate people returning back to work.
Right. And I also think we have community health workers that can fill the gap, and we can train community health people more quickly to fill in some of the roles and then allow the RNs, the registered nurses, to do the more acute type or more critical type of care.
Mm-hmm. So the contact tracing, if we had many more tests being administered, that contact tracing, for example, doesn't require an extremely high degree of medical training to do.
It does not, no.
Let's turn now to topics of our own personal care, if that's okay with you both, unless you have other comments you wanted to make.
No, that's good.
We're all concerned about ourselves and our families and our elders and our children. What are you advising people to do to be safe? What would you tell our listeners? Let's start with you, Professor Hicks. What would you tell our listeners? What would you tell your own family?
Well, I would tell my own family, and I tell this to people that, you know, who ask me these questions, pay attention to the experts. You know, pay attention to the infectious disease experts. Pay attention to data that's coming out of the CDC, that's coming out of NIH. Those are the people who are in the know. Those are the people that understand this disease and what needs to be done to protect the health of the public. And I think that, you know, they've been very clear so far about what works and what doesn't work. You know, so we know social distancing works. So as much as possible, stay home. If you are vulnerable, that is, if you have, if you're in any way immunocompromised, or you have contributing conditions like lung disease, heart disease, diabetes, what have you, you want to make. You want to be particularly careful about where you go and what you do when you get out there. Wash your hands. We've been telling, I mean, we grew up, our mothers telling us, wash your hands, right? Wash your hands. Wash your hands frequently. So I think that the people need to pay attention and do some of those really simple kinds of things to help the prevent the spread. You know, I see people walking around with masks and things. And if individuals have conditions that would make them more vulnerable to the virus, and they're using that mask to, or if they have, you know, they have a cough or they have a sneeze or something like that, and they're using that mask to help prevent that spread, that's great. But I see people walking around with like scarves around their mouths and things like that. Those kinds of things are not going to protect you from the virus. And so I think there's a lot of myth out there about, you know, what is protective and what's not protective. And but it's very clear that if you distance yourself socially, only go out if absolutely necessary. If you're sick, stay at home. You know, those are the kinds of things that work.
People have been talking about bandanas lately. Mm. I confess I actually dug into my deep sock drawer and found five old cowboy-sized handkerchiefs, and I put those out wondering if I should be worried about using them the next time I went out to get the mail. Want to talk a little bit more, Professor Nelson, a little bit about what kind of facial nasal protection makes sense? Taking a handkerchief or a winter scarf and wrapping it around my head, is that going to do me any good if I'm sick or if I'm not sick?
I don't think so. I agree with Frank. I think that it's really the basics. It's the hand washing, the social distancing. If you're sick, stay away from people. Don't go to the grocery store. We as a family decided not to go together when it comes to picking up a few groceries or going to the post office. One person goes, and we're avoiding big crowds. I agree. I think the masks are, if you're very vulnerable, I'm glad that we have masks available to our first responders. I have a nephew who's a firefighter, paramedic, and a nephew who's a police officer, and they're on the front lines. They need those masks at certain times when they're close to people. They can't always avoid to get close to people if you're trying to help them if it's an emergent or urgent situation. But some of the other basics are really just eating well, staying hydrated, sleeping, relaxing, walking. We spend a lot of time walking our pets and going outside. So I think it's just really the basics of staying healthy that will help people resist the virus even more if they're not vulnerable.
Let's talk a little bit more about the social distancing and family groups and social groups. I'm hearing reports that people think that this is a good time to have a party for 9 of your friends if you're supposed to not have groups of 10 or more. That's really not a good idea, is it?
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
And why isn't it a good idea?
Well, because you don't know who's infected. And, you know, there are people that are what we would call subclinical. In other words, they have the virus and they're able to spread the virus. They may not have any clinical symptomatology, or they're in the process of getting ill, and you're in this group of people, whether it be 5 people or 9 people, and you're spreading the virus. And so you don't know that this person is ill until, you know, 5, 10, 15, 14 days later they become ill. Well, by that point in time, it's too late. You know, that's why they keep telling people, stay away from groups, stay in your house, don't go places unless you absolutely have to. And then if you go out to places, make sure you do that social distancing, you know, make sure you stay at least 6 feet away from people. Don't shake people's hands. Don't come to close contact with people.
I carry a hand sanitizer with me everywhere and have been using it furiously more than I ever have before. Am I paranoid or am I being safe?
I think you're being safe.
I agree. Yeah. And if I could find it, I would use it.
I filled all my little bottles. One of the things that I'm not aware that I do is I like to touch things when I'm at the store. And my husband pointed that out and said, don't touch that unless you're going to pick it up, put it in the cart, and buy it. Because yes. He said, if I put it back, the next person touches it. And then that's just a way to transmit a virus as well.
That's right.
I think people are concerned about watching themselves and their family members for symptoms. Could we talk a little bit about the symptoms you should watch for? And we hear a lot about taking your temperature, but we never hear much lately about how to take your temperature properly and what instrument to use, what instruments you might use to take your temperature properly. Could you talk a little bit about that for our listeners, please?
Yeah, sure. Michelle, you want to do it? You want me to do it?
Sure. No, I'm happy to do it as well. Right. I don't know unless you're feeling ill that you have to take your temperature every day. I know that I was at, I stopped by an assisted living facility to drop some things off for my mom, and they take my temperature in order for me just to go into the lobby area. I don't know that that's really necessary if I'm well and not exhibiting any symptoms. So I would say, really it's the symptomology, it's the sore throat, the dry cough, the chest pain that would make me think, maybe I should start, I should check my temperature and make sure that I'm not running a fever. As far as thermometers go, funny, we've had a lot of different thermometers in our nursing lab, and I was able to kind of survey them. Some are not as reliable. Some of those disposable thermometers that are made out of paper, I don't think we found those to be very reliable. But an old-fashioned, either a digital thermometer orally. Some people do like the ear thermometer. We're using the ones that go across the forehead. You have to use them correctly in order for those to be accurate, because my temperature the other day was registered as 95. That's not exactly my temperature. But an oral temperature was 97.6, so that was a little bit more accurate. The most accurate temperature, of course, in an adult or a child would be a rectal temperature, but you're only going to do that when someone is very ill or they're an infant. So there are different modes and ways to take temperatures. Nowadays, if you do go to the drugstore or store to buy a thermometer, you're not going to find any on the shelf. So you may have to rely on family members having them. I know that we have a few probably left in our nursing lab, but I'm hoping that they'll be more available soon.
Professor Hicks, over at Carthage, anything to add, sir?
I would agree with what Rochelle said. And, you know, if people start to feel sick, if you start to feel feverish, if you start to feel achy, then yes, I think you probably do need to take your temperature and monitor your symptoms and see how they progress. I think what's important, or at least what I would like to express to the viewers, is You know, some of it's just common sense, and I think it's difficult to not be afraid at a time like this, but at some point you've got to pull yourself back from the anxiety and be rational about things and logical about things. And, you know, if you're feeling sick, then absolutely, you know, take your temperature, monitor your symptoms, you know, call your healthcare provider, see if they want you to come in. They may say, no, you know, it sounds like you just have a case of the flu, that kind of a thing. I would just make sure that I have to do this as well, and I'm a healthcare professional, because you can get wrapped up in the anxiety. Yeah, I have to pull myself back and say, what's logical here, and what do I really need to pay attention to? And so I think that people just need to use common sense and when it comes to the onset of these symptoms, and to be able to monitor them effectively, and not to necessarily panic. Not trying to say that they shouldn't take them seriously, but not to panic about it.
Any comments about proper quarantine procedures? If you're in a case where you yourself have to be quarantined because you've tested positive, or someone you have been in contact with has just tested positive, can you make a couple of quick points about how people, what are the do's and don'ts of quarantine, common mistakes, most important things to do? Would you like to start, Professor Nelson?
Sure. The person who is starting to show symptoms, they've tested, they have to be quarantined, they do need to follow the CDC guidelines, and that's a recommendation of 14 days. They should be, as much as they can, they should be socially distancing away from their family members. Depending on if you have people in your household that are vulnerable, young, older, have already some illnesses that make them a little bit more vulnerable, then I would definitely distance myself. But if you're already living with a family member and you've been exposed, I'm sure that you've already exposed your family member. So all the family members would need to be quarantined for the specified amount of time, and then tested, of course, afterwards, before they're able to be clear of the quarantine.
Anything else, Professor Hicks?
I think Rochelle's right on about that. You know, one thing I've seen kind of floating through websites and things like that is, do you need to be concerned about your pets? And there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that cats or dogs are vulnerable to this, and there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that they will carry this. There have been a couple of instances where dogs who were exposed to owners that were COVID positive did test positive for the virus, but there's absolutely no evidence that they would spread it from, spread that around. So I think that's important for people to hear.
I'd like to turn now to how long this is going to last. Lots of things are going through people's minds, including myself. No one is immune to this virus. So does that mean everyone is going to get it? Does that mean I'm 76 years old nearly, does that mean I shouldn't emerge from my house until there's a vaccine available for me? Thinking a little bit further ahead and in those terms, what would you counsel for people to do?
Well, you know, I think if you look at the curves that they're predicting, that they're predicting that this is probably going to extend into July. I think that if you look at some of the curves that have been produced for Wisconsin, they're looking for this to peak right around late April, early May, and then it's going to start to decline. I always think of, I love history, and I always go back to the flu epidemic of 1918. And not everybody got the flu in 1918, and even people who got the flu didn't necessarily die from the flu. It ran its course, and people were then able to come out of quarantine or self-quarantine. As far as individuals you know, quarantining themselves. Like you said, you know, you're 76 years old, you know, and you would be considered in a vulnerable population. Again, I think we just go back to the basics, you know, social distancing, use good common sense, wash your hands, think about what you're doing before you do it, like when you go to the grocery store, picking things up, those kinds of things. That's kind of where I come down on that. What do you think, Rochelle?
I agree with that. I think not everybody is going to get this. I think we're at some point, many of us are going to be exposed, but some healthy people will not get this virus. And at some point, we will study those healthy people to find out if that contributes to prevention in the future when we get to that point. Once it peaks and starts to go down, I'm hoping that we'll be able to return to some of our normal activities with some social distancing still. But heck, I don't know why we couldn't get outside a little bit more and be healthy. I'm seeing a lot of people walking and out and about in the parks. And I think that's a good thing. I'm seeing a lot of physical exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good for health in general.
It is, yes.
Could you talk a little bit more about what's a vulnerable person? Is it just age? Is it just gender? I mean, there's some people are saying that looks like men get this worse than women. Are there other things that we should be aware of that we haven't been talking about so much lately?
I think we're pretty aware that people that are of an older age are more vulnerable. We're now starting to see that we've seen some virus in infants. We are concerned about women who are pregnant so that we reduce the exposure to them as well. Anybody who has a pre-existing condition, especially diabetes, heart disease, any type of asthma, lung disease, they become a little bit more vulnerable because their immune system is a little bit more attacked. Someone who has cancer, who's immunosuppressed for another reason, they're a little bit more at risk than an average healthy woman or man.
A lot of comment has been made about how this affects the lungs, and they talk about the lower lungs being affected. Can you give a lay explanation of what goes on in the lungs with a disease like this that makes it a serious disease?
So from what I've read and I talked with other colleagues about, what essentially happens with this infection is that it does get into the lower respiratory tracts down into the air sacs, which we call the alveoli, and it causes the alveoli to flood with fluid, and it makes the lungs very, very stiff. And so what actually happens is a condition or a complication known as adult respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS, and that is very difficult to treat. Even with our modern ventilators, we still have a hard time treating that disorder because the care is basically supportive and trying to maintain the patient's oxygen levels and their blood. So help the lungs to repair themselves. So that's why this condition is so much more serious than the routine flu that people talk about, is because of the way that it affects the lungs. It's not just a pneumonia, even though people might feel like it's pneumonia. It's much more serious than that. It's really getting at the cellular level and causing flooding of the alveoli. And stiffening of the lungs, which makes it so much more difficult for people to breathe.
I see. So this is nothing like the normal pneumonia that I've gotten several times in my life after developing a bad chest cold.
No, this is much more serious than that. That's why this disease is so much more deadly.
All right, I have a real-life situation. Professor Nelson, you have a family member who's planned a vacation this summer during July and August. What are you going to tell them?
I'm going to tell them to stay home. I'm going to tell them not to travel. I have family members who live out of state, and we have some big family events coming up, and we've postponed those indefinitely because we don't know what's going to happen. We want to make sure that we're much healthier before anybody gets on a plane to travel to another state. Perhaps, you know, if we were a little closer by and we could hop in the car and avoid all of that, might be a different consideration. But for now, I'd say stay home. We don't know how long it's going to be before we're out of this danger zone of becoming sick from the virus.
Professor Hicks, what are you telling your family about summer vacations?
I would say exactly the same thing. I think that we're going to have to take a lot of wait and see attitudes and see how things go. But I agree with Rochelle. If I had someone asking me if they should think about going on a vacation August or even September, I would say I don't think I would plan at this point in time. You know, you could always take another vacation next year, right? But if you get
sick, you're alive,
exactly. If you get sick of that, then you know, what good is it? So I would do exactly the same thing.
I have a big picture question for you now, for both of you professors. Imagine that the year now reads on the calendar 2045. It's the 25th class reunion of your nursing class of 2020. At the professional sessions before the big evening party, what are they going to be saying at the session on the lessons we learned from the 2019-2020 pandemic? What do you think? Professor?
My students, knowing my students the way I do, I think my students will say they learned a lot about being flexible and adaptable. They learned a lot about alternative ways to learn, which I think would help them in their future careers, because nursing is a profession of lifelong learning. I think that they will, you know, many of my students are volunteering in other healthcare organizations, or many of them are what are known as student nurse and interns anyway, and are continuing to work through all this. And I think that they're going to have a sense of, they're going to have a sense that they contributed to the to improved outcomes for people, that they were there to help when there was a huge need, and that they were part of that.
Professor Nelson over at Parkside?
I agree with Frank. I think that even 10 years out, we're going to be looking at things differently. During the time that I had a small time that I worked in acute care, but most of my career has been in community and public health, I think we're going to see a lot of more health care in the community. We're not going to see as much acute care. We're going to see just a change in how we're delivering care, really promoting health promotion and follow-up. Some of the basics that we did so many years ago, we've learned from history, and I think we're going to learn a lot from this episode as well.
You think the nursing profession will have some profound changes in terms of the nursing profession and nursing education? I know you touched on that slightly earlier. Professor Hicks?
I do. I think they will. And, you know, we've been talking about this for a long time, and you can go back to the IOM report of 2010, you know, talking about the future of nursing. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about the things that Rochelle and I have been talking about now. But it hasn't moved, I don't think, at least for my taste, hasn't moved quickly enough. Letting nurses practice the full extent of their education experience, and elevating the educational standards of the profession, and looking more towards population/public health as a larger part of the curriculum than it is right now. So I think that the nursing profession should take advantage of this situation and claim its right among other healthcare professionals. And
thank you very much. Thank you both, Professor Hicks and Professor Nelson from Carthage and Parkside, respectively. We appreciate your being on the program this morning. And this is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters, urging all of you to get informed, get involved, and please stay home. Good day.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
Jazz, swing, blues, bop, and more is available 24 hours a day on your desktop, laptop, smartphone, or radio. To access 24/7 Jazz WGTD on your computer, go to WGTD.org, where you can listen live, online, 24 hours a day. On your smartphone, download the free WGTD app. In the Kenosha-Racine area, 24/7 Jazz WGTD HD2 is available via HD radio. For more information, call 262-564-3030.